Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is the second in a two-part series with Dr. Clotaire Rapai, author of The Culture Code, an ingenious way to understand why people around the world live and buy as they do. It was recorded in the last week of June 2006. You may hear the first part in this series on our website, www.radiocurious.org. The effect of the unconscious dimension of how people behave is discussed in The Future of International Understanding and how it will flow more freely from the use of the Internet and the activities of corporations, along with the differences between American education and culture and French education and culture, with some aspects of Chinese culture. Our discussion with Dr. Clotaire Rapai begins with his description of his new work that will compare Marco Polo and his discoveries with the instant worldwide communication that now exists.
My next project is a new book called The Marco Polo Principle. Marco Polo was the guy starting from Venice, and he went to China, and he opened up the world. I think that the world is going to be changed by merchants again, not by politicians, not by ideologues, not by a scientist, not by big parties, because that's the revolution of the mall, as I call it. I mean, I was in Indonesia, and I went to the mall there, and I could see some women in miniskirt and high heels next to women in burqas and completely covered. And so these two women together were there next to each other buying some shoes. And this notion of merchandise opening up the world of cultures, making cultures to connect again, that's the big idea. I think the people that are really changing the world are not the communists, not the socialists, not the capitalists, not all these isms, but just a merchant.
Well, looking at the culture code of the woman in the miniskirt and high heels next to the woman in the burqa, their culture is so different. How do they get beyond or closer than buying the shoes?
What was fascinating, that was in Kuala Lumpur, and these two women were from the same culture. They were within the same country, from the same origin and everything. And so the diversity here, and Malaysia is quite well known to have some, in some places like that, people from different cultures and different religions being able to live together. But the contact there, the fact that they might disagree on idea, they might disagree on the way they're supposed to be dressed, but the fact that they somewhere buying things together, and they were buying Prada, or they were buying some Lancel or Chanel, or, and so it's this mix of cultures through the product, I think this is where the next revolution is going to be.
As you travel around the United States, what differences do you see from region to region?
It's fascinating here because I do a lot of work in Europe. I do a lot of work in South America, in China, and so on. Of course, we have differences in America, but there are so many similarities that is quite amazing. I mean, we have 50 states in America where everywhere you can speak English, you can watch the same program on television, eat the same kind of food, go to the same kind of hotel. It's amazing, and it doesn't exist in Europe. In Europe, you go from one state to another, and you're completely different culture, different language, different food, different everything. And so we have similarities in the American culture. But, my example of the cheese and the quote for the cheese in America is that the cheese is dead. Well, I check in 50 states. The cheese is dead in 50 states. And so this is, again, for me, the power of the American culture, which is different from the Canadian culture. I think that we have a power to attract people that want to become American. And I know a lot of people are concerned about Hispanic, and they say, oh, now the South is going to be completely Hispanic, and Miami Beach, and It's just like you see people that, you know, they're different. Yes, but this is like every culture can bring a contribution to the American culture. But remember the Irish. For a while we say Irish don't apply when we had a job offer. You know, they didn't want the Irish. Then the Kennedy came, and then Ronald Reagan and all these people that, you know, and they almost brought some kind of nobility to the Irish dimension. Today, we're afraid about the 12 million Hispanics that speak Spanish. We don't want to speak to become a bilingual culture. Fine. But they're bringing something. They're bringing a contribution to the American culture. And I've done a lot of work with this Hispanic in the South, I can tell you. They want their children to be American. They want their children to speak English. I mean, that's why they came to America, because they believe in the American dream. And so, again, this is differences. We can see some differences, and we can look at differences. But on the other hand, there are so many similarities, which is quite amazing.
Are you familiar with Peter Wybrow and his book American Mania, More is Not Enough? Our interview with him may be found on the Radio Curious website, radiocurious.org. His thesis is that the people who come here almost have a genetic predisposition for change, like you refer to it in your book as to rebellion.
Yeah.
They're rebelling from the homeland. He talks about it, some people who are squeezed out of their country for political reasons or because primogeniture prevails. They come here and they breed with like people, which is the genetic production of the American soul, the adolescent soul, as you call it.
You know, I believe that. I'm with you there, and I think it's a great way to look at it, because I believe that I was an American before I became American. You know, I was predisposed for that. I wanted that all my life. You know, and I believe that sometimes I make a joke in Europe because people say, you know, how come American at the beginning were all European and there's such a big difference today between Europe and America? And I say, you know, guys, let me tell you something. I think the gutsy one were the one that crossed the Atlantic, and the lazy one that the one that stayed in Europe. And so there was a selection somewhere. And, you know, of course, it's a joke or it's a provocation here, but I believe there is something there. I think that, you know, my experience, for example, with the French in France, and I was born in France, is that the French are always jealous, and they envy you, and they don't like when you succeed, and you're supposed to hide when you make money, and they say, oh, you know, you're bad because you cannot make money if you don't exploit other people and things like that. But they never help you. They never help you. But when I came to New York for the first time, I crossed the Atlantic. I had no money. You know, I usually say I had to fight the Indians for 2 years to survive in Manhattan, you know, the cab driver. And I needed some help. And then I went to see some French people, and they told me, do you need some money? Do you need a place to stay? You want a car? You want an office? And I say, are you French? I couldn't believe these people were French. And they were different. They were already more American. They were positive thinkers. They were trying to help. They're community-oriented. I mean, amazing. And I didn't get this feeling with French people in France, but I got this feeling in New York, in Manhattan. And the French community there is just amazing. But it's the same for the Irish, it's the same for the Scots, it's the same for the Greek, it's the same for the Chinese. It's amazing.
Did you receive your education in America or France?
No, I studied that in Paris. I went to school and university and in France. I did some work in took some classes in New York State at New York University, but that was a long time ago.
How would you characterize the difference between French education and American education?
Oh, it's almost the opposite. The French education valorizes the abstract thinking, and so this is that's where all the notion of structure comes from. I mean, it's like the structuralism there. Abstract thinking, it's almost an art. You should be able to look at things in a very abstract thinking. When the Americans are very pragmatic, very concrete, very specific. And so the French think, and that's enough. You don't need to do anything with your brilliant ideas. You want to create a brilliant idea that is going to be to be completely useless. Because if it's useless, it has more value in terms of, this is a beauty. I mean, we call that l'art pour l'art, or the art for the sake of the art. You know, it's like if you try to make money with something, then you are vulgar. When in America, we want something very practical. What am I going to do with that? What is in there for me? How is it going to change my life? You know, we're very action-oriented, and the French are very idea-oriented.
It seems to me you've blended both in your work.
Yeah, well, that's what is great, to be both. I mean, this is, you know, because I love the French culture. I have a little problem with the French, which is another story, but the culture, the French culture is very interesting. But there is a dimension that is missing that I found in the American culture. And when you can have both sides, I mean, if you can look at the best, you know, I call that best practice. We use best practice in business, but we should use best practice in cultures. And each culture around the world has a best practice into something that we should learn from. We should respect, integrate it into the best way to deal with the whole world.
Well, then how do we learn what those best practices from other cultures are?
This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm studying cultures all around the world and helping big corporations to start implementing that. And I believe that the big changes in this best practice between cultures is not going to come from the academics, is not going to come from the politicians, is going to come from major corporations, from the, what I call the merchant that have to do integrate the different culture. They have to sell their products around the world. They have to bring new things from one culture to another, like Marco Polo used to do when he came back from China. And even the people in Venice at the time couldn't believe it. They didn't believe him. It was too much as a provocation of the world was so different. And so I believe that this is the mission of the major corporation. I was with a company recently, and I had a meeting with 10 people in a room. These 10 people were from 10 different cultures. In the same room, 10 people born in different places and different cultures, different nationality. I couldn't believe it. 10, not two of them were from the same culture. And so that is brilliant, because these people, they can think, they can be the team that can be a global team. They can look at the world and permanently look at what is it that we do right in Brazil, what is it that we do right in Germany or in France or in China, and how can we take all these best practices to create a better world.
Well, you spoke before about the similarity in America, the homogenation, the same food, the same hotel, the same view of cheese as being something dead, which has occurred in this country in the past 50 or 60 years. Even accents are going away. Do you see that happening in an international, worldwide level?
No, that definitely not. You know, I think that what is happening in the world right now is that we have a dimension through networking, internet, satellite, and everything. So some people tell me, oh, this is it. Now the world is going to have a global culture. What is happening is the opposite. Because every little culture is in danger, then it reinforces itself. I mean, look at Quebec, look at the French. I mean, the French are more French than ever. I mean, unfortunately, that's another story. But, you know, and so what is happening here now is that because of this communication network, some little cultures that were going to disappear, like if you take the Armenian of the world, they never been a big market in one place. But if they can be connected through the internet, all the Armenian of the world now become a big market, and they become interested. And so we're going to start recreating, going back to novels and books and things that are very Armenian, because we have a market there. And if you look at what the Soviets have tried to do with all the little cultures in the Soviet Union, when the Berlin Wall went down and the Soviet disappeared, all these little cultures that have been repressed for several generations, they popped out and they come back. I mean, it's amazing the comeback of the Slovenia and, you know, the Czech and the Hungarian. I mean, all these cultures have their strong identity and they're proud. One thing that maybe I want to emphasize here is that in order to be successful in the world today, you need to have a village of origin. I mean, if you want to be global, it's more than just to be local. It's to have a village of origin, a place where you're proud to be from, that you know. And one example I can give you is a fantastic brand, is one of my clients, and I love this brand, is Jack Daniel's. Jack Daniel's is a very successful brand worldwide, but they're not American. They're from Tennessee. And so it's a very different situation. I mean, the people that hate American will love Jack Daniels, but what they see there is a connection with something that is deeply rooted. You have roots. You have roots in your village, and you're proud of your village. And that is what is very important here.
So you see the role of the Internet as being able to manifest that on a worldwide plane?
Absolutely, because then you can go and discover the village. You see that you don't discover some kind of a global superficial dimension here. You can go and go in depth with little information on every village there, and so the return of the village is a big theme in the global world.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. Clotaire Rapai from his home in New York State, in the second of a two-part series about his book, The Culture Code, an ingenious way to understand why people around the world live and buy as they do. You may hear the first interview in this series at our website, radiocurious.org. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In our conversation, Dr. Clotaire Rapai, you seem to disparage the French culture without specifically telling us why, other than you characterize it as a pessimistic culture. Can you elaborate?
The French culture is always like a happy ending is kind of a Boy Scout, American, superficial, and is not the reality. A good movie is always a bad ending in France. I mean, because that's more real, more reality. And so it's in America, we always have the cavalry, arriving at the end and saving the guys from the Indians or whatever. The French say this is nonsense. Life is not like that. But on the other hand, what is interesting here is that in the French culture, this is not a positive thinking culture. You're proving how good you are because you can go into all the criticism and the negative side, and you can see all the negative. And this is a national sport to criticize. And so this notion here is that it's almost a proof of love if you criticize. If I don't criticize you, I don't really love you. It goes some very simple things, like, for example, when the French come to America and people smile at them, they say, "Why do they smile? Did I say anything funny?" I mean, they can't believe that people just smile. When you cross people in the street, you smile to people. I mean, I love to do that. I do that in America. But I don't do that in France, because you're not supposed to look at people like that and smile or be open to people. What is that? And maybe this is because the French were invaded by so many people for so many centuries all the time, that when you see somebody that you don't know is an enemy first, and it takes some time before it becomes a friend. So your first experience, the first imprint, I mean, what is the best door in France? It's not an open door. It's a drawbridge with machine guns, and a moat, because you don't know if the guys are going to attack you. I was amazed when I arrived in France to see that some of these places, people leave the door open and there is no gate around the garden. I mean, this is an open space. I live here in New York State, in Tuxedo. I don't have any gates. You can't tell where the limit between my land and my neighbor's land. I mean, this is just ongoing. And this is unknown in France. And so, it's almost a structure in people's mind here, is that you anticipate the worst. And because you anticipate the worst, then you try not to be too disappointed, whatever happened here.
There's some theory in genetic cultural history that the fear of somebody who looks different is a self-protective or a genetic in origin. You seem to be saying that about French culture, but not about American culture. Does that fit into your comparison of America being an adolescent culture and French being more mature?
Yes, in one way. But on the other hand, the situation here is that the American culture is a pioneer culture. And so there is something about circling the wagon at night. There is something about moving west. There's something about the discovery we have to pull together. I mean, which is very, very, we are individualistic in America too, but it's a different kind of code for individualism in France and individualism in America.
What is the difference in that code?
Well, the key element is community. I mean, in America, Alexis de Tocqueville already discovered that. There is always some kind of a community solution. We like to give, we like to share, we like to take care of the community. When in the French culture, because it goes back to centralization, Louis XIV, Napoleon, the state should be taking care of you. And so we have the community center in America where they have the state that is supposed to take care of you. And so the individualism is always you on your own and trying to take advantage of the state or pushing the state to do something for you. When we circle the wagon, the community, we try to find solution together and help each other more in the American culture.
How would you characterize some of the other extremely large cultures in the world, China or India, for example?
Yeah, your question about the different big cultures of the world. I think that the Chinese code is fascinating and very different from the India code. And again, very different from the American code. So if we take these three big cultures, they have a different code, and we have to understand that dimension there. The Chinese code, which is quite fascinating, is that it's almost like a return to the mother's womb. I mean, you know, the empire of the middle is like the navel of the world is China. And the empire of the middle, what the middle, the center of the universe. And what is quite interesting in when you want to do business with the Chinese is that going back centuries ago, people that will come and wanted to do business in China, they had to go to the Forbidden City to see the emperor, and they had to bow lower than the emperor. And if you don't bow lower than the emperor, then you cannot do business with them. And I think today is the same. You have to go to China, and the Communist Party now is a new emperor, still centralized, and if you don't bow lower, you cannot do business with them. And then another dimension that is very interesting in China is that they believe they invented everything. Going back to like 5,000 years ago, they invented everything. And because of that, they think that we stole everything from them. During the Opium War, we invaded China and we took a lot of things everything we could take out of China. So they resent that today. So today they're not copying anything. They're just taking back what is theirs. And that's why I don't believe when they say, you know, usually I don't believe what people say anyway, but definitely I don't believe what the Chinese say when they say, oh, we're going to go after, protecting copyrights and making sure that people don't copy things. That I don't believe them. This is just something they're going to do to pretend and to try to make Americans feel better. But it's like almost a divine right for them to take back what we took from them. And this is why I absolutely believe that sooner or later they're going to get Taiwan. They got Hong Kong, they got the Tibet, they got Macau, they're going to get Taiwan. Are they ready to fight for it? Of course, you bet. Oh, but, you know, people say, oh, they're not going to risk to lose the American market and they need the American market. That is a cortex thinking. Of course, logically, it's not logical to start a nuclear war for Taiwan. But at the gut level, you can't repress it. Unfortunately, the reptilian always wins. Why do you think they're spending so much money to become the number one nuclear naval power? They have one of the largest fleet, and they're investing like crazy there. So there is a risk, and we have to understand the three brain here. But at the gut level, the Chinese are never going to give up Taiwan.
You said that generally you don't believe people. Where do you draw the line to decide to believe people?
Well, you see, you cannot ask people, tell me what you're not aware of, because they cannot tell you if they're not aware of. Tell me what is unconscious. What if it's unconscious? I can't tell it. I'm not conscious about it. So we have to discover. That's why my company is called Archetype Discoveries Worldwide. We try to discover what is it that make people do what they do, move the way they do, buy, vote, behave the way they do. And that is an unconscious dimension. And sometimes they're just not aware. So they will tell you, most of the time when you ask questions to people, they tell you what their cortex tell you to tell you. So, you know, what makes sense, what is logical. I mean, if you look at what is going on right now with gas mileage and the big SUVs, and we know this is ridiculous, but people keep buying SUVs. And so why do they do that? Well, because at the gut level, I mean, if the terrorists attack you tomorrow, and you have to cross the continent and to fight, you better be in a Hummer with a machine gun than in a Honda Civic that is hybrid. It's a gut feeling that you have that in order to survive, you better be strong and powerful and tall and look down to people. I mean, it's a feeling of survival here. And so at the cortex level, it doesn't make sense. But if you don't understand the gut level, you don't understand why people do what they do.
Dr. Clotaire Rapaille, author of The Culture Code, an ingenious way to understand why people around the world live and buy as they do. Thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about another interesting book that you would recommend?
One that I like is a book by Jack Welch, and it's not a new book, but it's called From the Gut. And, you know, again, it's amazing to see that some very powerful and guy from a big corporation like GE trusted his guts. And the gut level is so important. You know, it's just like this is where we have to connect it. The big problem with intellectuals is that sometimes they disconnected with their guts, the gut feeling. And I think that this notion of from the guts, being connected with your guts to make big decisions, to decide for, you know, the way a big corporation is going to go ahead. And I think this is a brilliant message.
Dr. Clotaire Rapaille, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure.
This has been the second in a two-part series with Dr. Clotaire Rapaille, author of The Culture Code, an ingenious way to understand why people around the world live and buy as they do. The book Dr. Rapaille recommends is Straight from the Gut by Jack Welch. You may hear the first part in this series on our website, www.radiocurious.org. And you may learn more about the work of Dr. Rapaille at his website, www.archetypediscoveriesworldwide. That's archetype discoveriesworldwide.com. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.